We're joined by the University of Utah men's basketball coach, Larry Kruskowiak. Again, thanks again, coach, for making time. I guess that's kind of the first question is your job going to be a lot harder now that you're going to have to spend so much time watching Toronto Raptor games?
Well, unfortunately, during a college season, it's really hard to catch. I mean, we have the Utah Jazz here in town, and I might see two of their games all year. So you get kind of overwhelmed with your own program. You don't get a chance to catch them very often. But certainly, I'll probably have to try twice as hard now since the two guys we have are at the same spot. So maybe we'll have to pay a little closer attention.
Yeah, and they figure to probably get some minutes together the way that we're looking at things. So you're not ready so even though you are in Utah, which is basketball crazy, you're not willing to say that the Jazz are now number two behind the Raptors. You're not willing to put that as the Utah Utes official NBA team.
Well, you know what? It's politically correct. I'd probably get myself in trouble, but from the heart, I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's something I think is quite natural, and I think there's probably a lot of basketball fans here in Utah as well, in Salt Lake City, that are going to be paying a little bit closer attention to the Raptors. Those kids, they're great kids, and we feel like they've got an opportunity to lend a hand and help with some of the success up there.
Well, you know, that's something I'm curious to get your read on, because last year, especially before Corey Joseph had signed, the pick of DeLon Wright seemed to make a ton of sense. I mean, pretty much universally up here, everybody had looked at him and as a Bob Cousy Award winner, a guy that, you know, was a senior, a guy that could step in right away, that offered a lot of intangibles that the Raptors were looking for. This year with Jakob, while we're fans of the pick and most people we find are fans of it, it was a little bit, for some, strange to see the Raptors take a center that had, to many, what we were billed as a guy that was similar to Jonas Valanciunas. You were with him at the draft, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So when you were there and you were in the green room and his name got called by the Toronto Raptors, your immediate gut thought, like not knowing that team or what you know of them, was what?
Well, I mean, there's really nothing negative short of, you know, being a 2-hour time zone difference and being in the Eastern Conference, and from a selfish point of view, maybe you'd like to, you know, to be able to catch them two or three times here in Salt Lake City instead of the one time. But I mean, from top to bottom, number one, you talk about similarities between Valanciunas. I mean, you're better at saying it than I am, but, and I don't think there's anything wrong with having players that are similar, you know. I think Jakob's probably more of an athlete, getting up and down the floor and a little more agile, less of a back-to-the-basket type player. But if you can land another one of those big guys, I think you'd take him. And without a doubt, I felt like Jakob, I mean, I had a horse in the race, obviously, so I felt Jakob was the best big. And as the draft played out, Toronto felt like he was the best big. And you just don't find kids that often at that size that are – it's still on that learning curve. I think what he's shown from rookie year or his freshman year here in college to his sophomore year, if that's any indication, the kind of graph that he's going to be on once he gets to the NBA, I think that's nothing but positive.
You've got a tough to pronounce name too. So you and Valanciunas got to figure it out. There's a brotherhood there that I know that you got to have with the tough to pronounce names guys.
Yeah. Eastern European guys. It doesn't exactly roll off my tongue, yeah. But no, it's good. It's going to be real interesting watching that play out. And I'm with you. You know, I thought DeLon was great. They obviously got a great pick, a great trade a year ago when they got Corey Joseph. But I still think DeLon's going to be able to crack that lineup, and hopefully we'll see both those guys making each other better.
The immediate thought from Raptors fans was, okay, where does Jakob fit right away? Is he going to be someone who comes off the bench? Can he play with JV? Different draft sites had him projecting at different spots. Do you see him, you know, over the course of his career being more of a four or a five?
Well, he was always a five here. You know, I think a lot of times in systems, it depends, you know, what type of offense you run. The one thing I do know, like here at Utah, our fours and fives are interchangeable. We run a type of offense where, if you know the four, you can play the five. So it's really no separating those two. The difference comes in who you can guard on the defensive end. You know, I've always said, well, you're the four if you're guarding their four, and you're the five if you're guarding their five. And the one thing I think about Jakob And I also feel like it's part of the reason that he was drafted as high as he was. The kind of the flavor of the month in the NBA right now as we watch the finals was there's an awful lot of switching going on. You know, NBA players, and I've said for years, I thought there should be more switching because so much of it's pick and roll. And when you try to impact the ball with two people or send two people to the ball, obviously one guy's open, you get in rotations, and I think open shots end up hurting a lot of teams. And what we saw in the finals was an awful lot of switching. You keep guys in front of you, and that's what Jakob does a tremendous job of. 2 years ago when we made our run to the Sweet 16, and we played Georgetown and Stephen F. Austin, who were two really good pick-and-roll teams, and we just made a decision that we were going to switch. And Jakob's been tremendous at keeping a guard, a smaller guard in front of him, uses length. If he does get to the rim, he does a nice job of challenging shots at the rim. So, you know, I think from a defensive point of view, he's going to be able to guard either one. Now, he's not a guy that's going to be out shooting threes, you know, and stretching the floor, which is a little bit counterintuitive when you talk about how he fits in defensively. Maybe from an offensive point of view, I don't know if both those guys are going to be able to play at the same time. That's going to be up to Coach Casey to try to determine and figure out if there's some offense he can implement that would take advantage of them at the same time.
You mentioned all the switching that we're seeing now in the game, and you know, I kind of feel like that's happening because we don't really have any back-to-the-basket guys who you can throw it to and punish teams in isolation and get a basket. Is he a guy who you think can get his offense on his own, or will he have to kind of be a secondary or third option?
Well, I think it starts in transition. He runs as well as anybody. Obviously, if he's the one rebounding the ball, which he does a nice job of on the defensive glass, then he may not be as involved in the break in terms of getting down and trying to be an early threat. As I said, he's really good in pick and roll. And if he's the trail big coming in, and I know from watching the Raptors, you see a lot of pick and roll. You try to take advantage of the guards that they've got. You know, anytime you got Lowry, it's good to run pick and roll. So Jakob's going to be able to try to free him, and you're going to notice it. You don't know it now, but in all of my years playing and coaching, I'm not sure that I've seen a young man with as good a set of hands as Jakob has. You can throw a pass, I've always said, about 10, 11 feet in a diameter, whether it's 3 feet over his head or down at the ground, and he makes the guard look pretty darn good. He's able to get his mitts on it, and it's never a turnover. So when you talk about some of that early phase offense, I think he's going to be really good in that. And then he made such great strides. We wanted to put him in a position and start our offense with him with this back to the basket. And I think he's really going to start to excel when he sees some single coverage. You know, teams in the NBA initially aren't going to be interested in doubling him. He's going to have to prove up. And he went through such a difficult time, I think, as a sophomore here. Every time he got the ball, he saw every imaginable double team you can think of. So, you know, he's a guy you can throw it to in the post. And if you double him, he's a tremendous passer. So, you know, I think he's gonna find his way. He's going to find a niche and figure out, you know, if he's not on the court initially, he's going to figure out a way to get on the court. He's one of those kind of kids, and he's special that way in terms of figuring it out, and he's got a lot of different weapons.
Yeah, it's crazy to me because, you know, if we're talking 10 years ago, I mean, well, we're not talking because this guy's going, like, he's being debated as the top pick. Like, you're talking about a legit 7-footer with good feet, good hands, that you can say that can defend out in the pick and roll, pass out of double teams with nice touch around the basket and good offensive instincts. Like, this, the way that the NBA was, this guy's a shoe-in pick, especially, like, I don't think anybody would really disagree with you that he was the best center prospect this year in the draft anyways. The way that the game is going, though, where, you know, and you addressed this a little bit earlier, saying that he can switch. He's done a good job at that. You don't expect him to be a guy that can stretch it out very much. But what do you think when you look at the NBA today and what they're asking of big men, the one area that Poeltl has to work on and really has to improve in order for him to be like a starter from, I don't know, at some point in his career and have a lengthy career as a starting big in the NBA?
Yeah, you know, I don't think we should get too carried away based on the fact that we had Cleveland and Golden State in the NBA Finals, both fine teams, obviously.
Well, even you saw how Golden State struggled when they lost Bogut, right? A guy that you're very familiar with.
That's kind of my point. You know, those teams played small, and it's a very copycat-type league. And obviously the three-point shot adds up a lot faster than the twos. But, man, when you've got a legitimate big guy that can score in a one-on-one situation and you put all the pieces together, I still think there's place for the big man in an NBA game. And not to be overlooked. And the one thing I noticed, as you mentioned with Bogut being out, you didn't have a rim protector. You know, you had a guy like LeBron, you know, some wings that could get down in the paint. I think even Kyrie Irving and his ability to finish at the rim without a legitimate rim protector ended up being real costly. And they could have really used a big down there with some agility and some size and length. So, you know, I don't think it's all of a sudden the game has changed. We're losing the bigs. I think what's happening is the game has evolved because there's fewer and fewer bigs out there. But I still think if you look at a Duncan, you know, you look at some of the bigs that have had an impact on the game and won championships, when you can combine a perimeter team and some shooting and some wings and ball handling, as I mentioned with Lowry and Joseph and those guys, and you complement them with a real solid big, I think you can just as easily win a championship with that blueprint as you can what we witnessed in the finals.
Yeah, that's the really interesting thing to me about the Raptors season this year, or at least that blueprint that you talk about, is it looks like now Toronto has two guys that can give you, you know, 48 minutes of big men that can protect the basket and can play in the pick and roll and can receive the ball down on the low block and force defenses to give double teams. And I know you said that Poeltl's not going to get that right away, but I mean, you look at the tape and this is a guy that, you know, with his size and skill set, it seems like that's just an inevitability in the game. So I'm excited to see it. I'm just curious as to whether or not, you know, it's going to be something that ends up working, that ends up working out. But either way, I thought that this was the right gamble for Toronto to take.
Yeah, it sure made sense to me, you know, I just think his best basketball is ahead of him too. He could have come out as a freshman, wasn't, you know, projected in the lottery, would have been near the lottery, somewhere in the first round. And what we witnessed for his improvements, maybe four or five things that he addressed in the offseason, went from a 46% free throw shooter to a 70% free throw shooter, stayed out of foul trouble, put on 30 pounds, everything that we said he needed to do in order to get better and have more success, he did it. So, you know, sometimes you take a flyer on these freshmen, NBA teams do, after seeing them play for 1 year, and you don't quite know what they're made of and if they're willing to work on their game and address their weaknesses. Now, when Dwayne Casey gives Jakob a list of 3 to 5 things, hey, buddy, this is what we need you to do, I can promise you without a doubt that he's the type of person that's going to accomplish that. And I think that second year in college really, I think that proved that. And his best basketball is ahead of him, and I think he's in a super positive spot, a team that can compete in the East, you know, got all-stars on the team, a rabid fan base, a culture that's in place. I know Coach Casey quite well, and I know things are being done the right way, and he's going to be taught pretty quickly how to become a pro, which I think sometimes doesn't get talked about as these young kids end up, you know, going to teams that maybe the franchise culture is not in place and it's broken. And Jakob's going to eat all of that up, and I think it's a perfect fit for him. Plus, he gets to catch up with his old running mate, DeLon, and that's going to help the process, I think, speed up even a little bit more.
Do you look at this draft class, and like you mentioned, Jakob, the way that he came back and the way that he improved, and you pull up even just like his numbers and they leap off the page, just the improvements in all areas of his game. And then you see some of these guys that slipped later in the round, Murray from Washington, a guy that you're probably pretty familiar with from playing against a bunch, and Davis in Michigan, a bunch of freshmen that went out, Labissiere in Kentucky, that ended up sliding in the draft. Do you think that this year was a little bit of an eye-opener for this guy, some of these guys, or does this change nothing? And I guess lastly, I know this is a lot of questions kind of in one, Do you think it's an epidemic that guys leave too soon?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. There was no question at all about Jakob's ability to play the game. And then I think what you see, I've been on that end of it when I was involved with the Bucks, is you bring all these potential draft picks in. you spend a couple days with them, you have them do testing. I know when he was in Orlando, for example, I was told by the Orlando Magic that they've been administering a basketball IQ test ever since they've been drafting teams, and I played for Orlando in their second year, so it's 20-some years.
Pretty sure you fought Shaq there, too, no? Is that not true?
Yeah, no, doing these tests, and nobody's tested higher. Jakob had a score that nobody in all time had tested that high. So, you know, that's one of the things I think is we can see what a guy does on the court, but you can't measure some of these mental things and the probability that a guy's going to keep improving and that he's never going to embarrass your franchise and he's going to get along in the locker room and become a good teammate. And so I think he answered those questions by a lot of this pre-draft, all those interviews. And it's a shame. You know, I was in that green room, and what people don't understand, if you're not sitting in there, is there's so much excitement. I mean, everybody's going over on buses. You got family members. You get to invite six people to sit at your table. And it's really an amazing emotional time. And then all of a sudden you get to pick 10, and they pick Thon Maker. Well, Thon wasn't invited to the green room, so he comes up about halfway down the arena there at Barclays with his, you know, family. And then the next guy's picked, nobody's heard of. And you start to see the life kind of come out of the room. The energy is leaving the room. And, you know, tables are looking at each other like, well, where did this kid come from? So, in a sense, it's an unbelievably powerful day for a guy like Jakob or the guys that it works out for. But it's a boulevard of broken dreams sometime for some of the other kids that have to get up and leave the green room because they're the last table there or, you know, some of that embarrassment. So, it's a gamble, and I think, you know, I'd like to see that. I know they opened it up and allowed kids to come back to college, and you know, if it didn't work out the way, I'd like to see a little bit more freedom, and I understand that would put more pressure on college coaches to not know for sure, but I think our focus should be on making sure we're giving these guys a chance to succeed in the best possible way, and some of those mistakes hopefully wouldn't happen, but you know, it's a dream for so many kids, and sometimes you need a little bit more time in college to make it pan out. I think Jakob's a perfect story for that, on where he could have been his freshman year and where he ended up his sophomore year and how much fun, you know, the college experience is. I think kids get teased into that once a college season is over because the emotion is gone and you're kind of getting teased. Well, the only thing in the media when a college season is over is coaches being hired and fired and which kids are putting their name in the draft. And I think a lot of kids want to still be involved with that and don't think about it in a long-term sense as much as they should.
You hit the nail on the head. And something I had a theory about is I don't really understand, and maybe there's complications I'm not considering, but why the league can't say, you know what, even if you draft a kid, if you don't see him playing for you, he can go back to college. The same thing we see in baseball and in other sports. The Celtics had 6 picks. Half of them really aren't ready to play in the NBA. Teams are stashing guys in Europe because they're not ready to play. Is there an issue with saying, even if you have a guy's rights, put the money in an escrow account, let him go and develop in the NCAA? Is there a loser in that proposition?
You know, I think they're two separate entities. I don't think college is necessarily a minor league system for the NBA. I think what you're seeing now is more D-League development. I know they're trying to get a franchise, a D-League development team in each city to be a direct farm, you know, team like in baseball for the NBA. And I know those salaries are going to go up. I've been told minimum salary in the D-League is going to go from $20,000 to $30,000 to $80,000 to $100,000. And, you know, I don't think that's good for college basketball. From my perspective, it's going to mean a lot more kids are going to probably throw their name in the hat. And if they don't get drafted, then they go get a decent paying job at a D-League program. And, I don't think the NCAA and the NBA are necessarily have the same interest in mind. They're two separate entities that both want to succeed, and they're not necessarily tied in like you might find in some of these other sports with the farm system. But I do think in the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to see a revamping of a minor league system and give these kids an opportunity to maybe work on their game and do it you know, under the franchise tag in an NBDL type situation. So it's, you know, it's not looking good for college basketball with the way we're going. But it, I like your idea, but I just don't think they're necessarily teammates in it.
What's the what's been the key to the success you've had developing pros in Utah? You're obviously an NBA guy who runs an NBA system, but a tough old school coach. Why do you think the Raptors have gone back to the well twice in a row?
Well, I don't know. I, you know, as you ask that question, I'm getting goosebumps. I like the thought of it. You know, we had, as you mentioned, with DeLon, a Bob Cousy Award winner who's a point guard, and Jakob wins the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Award as the top center. And I don't think we necessarily have a system here in Utah where we go out and recruit guys to fit our system. I think we try to recruit high-character kids that are obviously talented, and I think one player in a basketball team can make you pretty darn good. And we spent 2 years building our team around DeLon, and then we completely revamped everything in Jakob's sophomore year and said, wait a minute, we got to figure out a way to make this kid good. So, you know, to be able to change and adapt and really try to enhance our best players and try to put them in a position where they can be successful, I think that might be one of the things that we really, you know, we really hang our hat on, and we're going to continue to do that in recruiting and talk about, you know, this isn't a system you have to come in and fit into. We're going to work on your weaknesses, address those, and put you in a position to take full advantage of what it is you do well, and then obviously work on the things you don't do well. And hopefully that translates to an NBA successful career for those guys.
Before we let you go, Coach, and first of all, you're obviously doing something right there in Utah. Because when you showed up there, I think that your first year there, what, the program finished 11th, and now two straight years finished second in the Pac-12. So obviously a lot's going well for you guys. The last thing before we let you go, we just got to ask you one thing about international players. We looked up at the year that you were drafted in 86, not to date you.
Yeah.
Six international guys. Out of 134, draft was different back then again. And that's the Sabonis year and the Petrovic year. Incredibly, Sabonis' kid is now drafted into the NBA. You look at right now, I mean, 26 international players selected out of 60 picks in the NBA draft. Like, how does this change things for you as a coach? And did you honestly ever see a day where it was going to be like this when you saw a guy like Sabonis? I don't even know how much you would have seen of him. But just knowing players of their ilk.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The night that you talk about with Arvydas Sabonis was the same year I was drafted, and I got a call the night before the draft from the Portland Trail Blazers, and they said, "We want you to sleep really well tonight because the worst case scenario tomorrow is we're going to take you with the 24th pick," and that was at that time the last pick of the first round. The Blazers had the best regular season record, and so I'm sitting there with my family and friends watching it on ESPN, and with the 24th pick, the Portland Trail Blazers select Arvydas Sabonis, and that was the very first time, if I'm not mistaken, in the history of the NBA draft that anybody had reached over across our borders and picked somebody. And you know, as I'm sitting at that draft, the green room the other night, I thought, man, how has this come full circle? Because in the adjacent table to us, there's Arvydas and his son and their family. And as you look around, you go, holy cow, what's happened since 86, you know, with our draft? And I think there's an awful lot. The thing that I have a problem with, and I'm not running NBA franchises to know what it is they're thinking, but there's an awful lot of good U.S. players. There's a big kid, for example, from Arizona, Tarzowski, Caleb Tarzowski, who's 7 foot, 260 pounds. He's as ready to play in the NBA as anybody. And there's a kid that goes undrafted, you know. And I just think we've almost flipped, and I understand the skill level and what's going on internationally, and maybe it's more of an athletic you know, a lot of AAU ball, and I call it dribble, pass, and tear ass. It's not necessarily as organized and skill-laden as a European deal would be, but I think we've almost gone over the deep end on the other side and forgotten that there's a heck of a lot of worthy players within the United States that really should be drafted, and then we can get away from some of that, you know, picking all these 18-year-old European kids that, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, especially in light of the fact that we've only got 2 rounds.
Yep.
You know, it's not like we have 10 rounds of the draft like you would have had, or 8 rounds of the draft where you can afford to take these kids. So, again, I think it's not doing us any good in the college game. You know, it's you know, the blueprint to get to the NBA, like you said, almost half the kids are coming from abroad, and many of those kids nobody's ever heard of. It's really kind of changing the landscape a little bit, and it does have to change what we do in, as recruiters. You know, we've got 4 international kids on our team right now. It's always been one of our niches, I think, the Bogats and, you know, the Medellas, and there's a long list of international kids. Jakob, obviously, on that list now. And you try to bring those kids over and get them ready for the NBA draft. So you have to take a closer look at how you're doing your business.
I will say that it's fun for guys like Donovan and I when we spend, you know, hours of watching tapes and reading scouting profiles and trying to talk to people about these college players. And then you have your GM take a guy named Bruno Caboclo from Brazil who has 2 clips of him on YouTube that are like basically in black and white, shot from like an old footage. So yeah, we sympathize with you a little bit there. Hey, Coach, again, thanks so much for making time for us today. Appreciate you being so generous with the time, and best of luck to you in the program.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good to talk to you guys.
Hey, cheers.
Appreciate it.